I'm Lynn Scherr, sitting in for Celeste Headlee, here with John Hockenberry. And John, it's your favorite subject now. We're going to the Euro.
The Euro has dropped
to its lowest point since the collapse of Lehman Brothers. And, you know, that was a couple of years ago, folks. This is not the way it was supposed to be, especially after the European Union announced a $1 trillion bailout. I did say trillion, that's with a T-R, which was supposed to shock the European financial system back to health. So, Louise Story, finance reporter, Wall Street and finance reporter for the New York Times. If $1 trillion can't do it, what can?
It's been on a nosedive. You might have seen this morning, actually, the euro fell further. Now it's fallen to a four-year low of $1.22. And you might be thinking, great, I can travel to Europe more cheaply. So, you know, a lot of listeners are probably happy. But the concern is, what is this saying to us all about the confidence in Europe? And one of the things that's going on here is you have a number of big traders, big hedge funds that are betting that the European Union's currency, euro, that the days are numbered, that the euro may be disbanded in some form or some countries taken out of it. And so that's a big bet against the euro out there.
Do they know something or are they just basically following on? You can make money betting negatively. Lots of people made tons of money during the financial crisis.
Right.
They're just doing the same thing this time around.
Well, there are interesting parallels between this and the financial crisis in the U.S. because at some point, the financial crisis here became about confidence in the banks. And it's really hard to get confidence back. You know, it's like air sucked out of a balloon. It's hard to get it back in there.
But it's even less physical than that. This idea of confidence in a financial crisis has always struck me as it's so amorphous. I mean, how do you put your fingers on it and how do you figure it out? I mean, we have Paul Volcker, who was advising the Obama administration, used the word the other day, disintegrate, that the euro might disintegrate. How do you get that confidence back?
That's exactly the challenge for policymakers. You can always see in retrospect what may have been the tipping point, what may have brought the confidence back. You know, now when we look back at the financial crisis here, the stress test that the banks went through about a year ago, which kind of laid out all of their problems on the table, seems to have been what turned the corner and brought the confidence back to the banks.
They're making tons of profits.
Right, now they're making tons of profits. They've got good stock prices, you know. So the question is, what will be?
The euro can't do that, though.
But what's the equivalent? What could be done? Is there something like that that could be done?
But we were talking over the weekend, some friends of mine, you know, people travel, they have euros in their their pocket. You know, it used to be, you look at a euro, you see Germany, right? Now you look at a euro, you see Greece and Portugal and Spain, and you're not thinking confidence. It's a psychological thing.
That's back to that confidence.
Right.
Play it out, Louise. What happens if the euro falls? What happens if the euro, in Paul Volcker's words, disintegrates?
So, you know, it's a double-edged sword because as it falls, it's also better for European exporters. You know, Mercedes-Benz actually in the first quarter, their sales to the U.S. were up significantly. Mm. And because part of the problem here is a fundamental problem in the economies of Europe, you know, you could argue that maybe seeing their exports go up a little will help. But the euro is an important benchmark. And if it fell too far, people might really start asking even deeper questions.
Well, euro for a while was a flight to quality currency. I mean, and it was sort of in some sense a net underneath the dollar. Okay, so the dollar is the ultimate sort of safe haven, but the euro was a pretty good safe haven there for a while. The euro goes away, it's like the dollar all by itself.
Well, and the other thing to watch is when interest rates go up, and people are expecting that the U.S. will increase interest rates before the euro, and that would mean that investors even more so will want to be in the dollar if they can get paid a higher return for being in the dollar. So that's another thing to watch is interest rates, because Europe is not in a good position to raise interest rates anytime soon.
All right, Louise Story, Wall Street and finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Thank you. I'd like to say I wish you had the answer to this, and even you don't have the answer. John?
Well, to our listeners, a lot of people thinking about the euro, a lot of people thinking about what our friend Patrick Henry Bass brought to us last week, literary editor at Essence Magazine. He came by to suggest a reading list for Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan. And many of you had your own reading list suggestions.
Yes, I think that Elena Kagan needs to read First Amendment opinions that the Supreme Court has handed down, since she's displayed great hostility to free speech in her 1996 Law Review article. This is Peter from Massachusetts.
Peter's referring to an article Kagan wrote while at the University of Chicago that critics say advocates a tolerance for censorship.
Herb Ziegler suggested a history lesson at thetakeaway.org. He writes, Kagan and all the justices should read The Age of Betrayal, The Triumph of Money in America by Jack Beatty. It is wonderfully written, and it details how the Supreme Court of the late 19th century created the corporate democracy that is the United States today.
Jay from Columbia, South Carolina, thinks Kagan should check out one of America's most popular authors, John Grisham's only work of nonfiction, Jay writes, The Innocent Man, a chilling and cautionary tale of a criminal justice system all too willing to convict the innocent and turn a blind eye to any evidence exonerating the convicted, no matter how compelling or corruptly obtained.
Others of you, though, might have suggested a little lighter fare after all. It's almost summer.
Hi. My name is Lisa Portwhite, and I would like to suggest that Ms. Kagan read Christopher Buckley's Supreme Courtship, a satire of the Supreme Court.
Get some laughs, Elena, because you'll have a few of them once you're on the court. And you can now text us from your mobile phone. This is what one listener did to make this suggestion. Kagan should read Whitman's poetry to participate in a celebration of the best parts of American character before she goes before the Senate and experiences what this texter says is going to be the worst.
A lot of cynicism out there, Janet.
Yeah, well, you know, our listeners, you know, they're watching out for Elena Kagan, they're watching out for us, they're watching out for democracy. If you want to text us, text the word TAKE to 69866, and we'll give you instructions from there. Again, text TAKE, T-A-K-E, to 69866. Message and data rates may apply. So many ways to get in touch with us.
Well, what is your take? Have you got a suggestion for the Supreme Court nominee book club? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment on our website, thetakeaway.org.
Book publicists have not been contacting us, which I think is good.
Yet.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.